This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, February 7th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, John Brennan, faces a Senate confirmation hearing and questions about his role in the controversial drone killing program. A federal appeals court considers a challenge to U.S. detentions without trial in the National Defense Authorization Act.
What's happening in this court now is the last thin line of defense between protecting what is left of our anemic democracy and the imposition of a military state.
And we'll go to Nagaland to hear how the internet and social media is providing a venue for dialogue about one of India's oldest ethnic conflicts. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. German police raided the homes of freelance photojournalists across the country yesterday. They're searching for photographs of a demonstrator who allegedly attacked a police officer at an anti-capitalist protest in Frankfurt in May 2012. But the raids have called into question the freedom of press in Germany and drawn criticism from politicians and the German Journalists Association. FSRN's Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
German photojournalist Thomas Rasloff just got back from 2 weeks in Syria. He's the photographer who captured the shocking images of over 70 bodies by the river in Aleppo, which is the largest recorded mass execution of the Syrian civil war. Returning to Berlin last night, he discovered that the police had raided his apartment. They confiscated his computers, hard drives, SD cards, USB sticks and cell phones.
I have told the police 6 months ago I haven't any picture of this crime scene and this demonstration.
Rasloff remembers the demonstration where he was up the front with the other photojournalists.
All the photographers were looking in front of the demonstration for violence, and the violence was in the back of the demonstration, so no photographer was there. So I don't know why the police is thinking we have pictures. We couldn't take pictures.
Rasloff says he's seen increasing police violence against journalists and photographers at demonstrations. While the German police have accused some photographers of being members of the left-wing scene. The German Journalists Association has condemned the raids, as have the German Greens Party. It's unclear when police will return the files and equipment, but they say they will if their suspicions are incorrect. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Berlin.
A group of Russian human rights organizations is challenging a law that requires them to register as foreign agents because they engage in political work that is supported from abroad. They sent the claim to the European Court of Human Rights today. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
11 human rights and environmental groups involved in the suit say the law violates the European Convention on Human Rights. They say it essentially labels them as spies and that organizations risk sanctions or closure for violating the complicated bureaucratic requirements. Oleg Orlov is the head of the human rights group Memorial.
From our point of view, all this set of unclear, absurd demands was done only for one purpose, to groundlessly denigrate certain organizations in the eyes of Russian society.
The foreign agents law is part of a larger effort to restrict the activities of organizations, particularly those with ties to the United States. The latest law prohibits Russians who have American citizenship from heading Russian NGOs. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
Approximately 50 schools in southern Senegal are closed today after a renewal of fighting this week between government forces and rebels with the Movement of Democratic Forces of Casamance. FSRN's Alpha Jallo is in the region and spoke with those affected.
Sofia Tugbojang is a seventh grader in Goudoum, a town in Senegal, restive Casamance region.
Because of the fighting here, we cannot go to school. All our teachers have left for security reasons. We want the government to help us.
Since last year, several schools have not been operating normally due to clashes between the Senegalese government and independence fighters with MFDC. But renewed clashes last weekend left 6 people dead, including 2 civilians, and many local school teachers temporarily suspended classes, affecting hundreds of students. Adama Jeju has four children who are currently not attending regular classes.
You see, last year the same thing happened here. Our children were asked by their teachers not to come to school. We also cannot blame the teachers because many of them are afraid that they can be hurt. All we need is the government to protect the schools and the general population.
President Macky Sall says his government will open dialogue with the rebels in the coming months. Alpha Diallo, Free Speech Radio News, Casamance, Southern Senegal.
Vietnam has released a prominent human rights lawyer from prison, but has also intensified its crackdown against activists and bloggers. FSRN's Mike Ives reports from Hanoi.
Authorities here released Lê Quang Ding Wednesday after he served 3.5 years of a 5-year term. Ding studied at Tulane University and served as vice chairman of Ho Chi Minh City's Bar Association. He was arrested in 2009 on subversion charges after calling for political pluralism. The U.S. Embassy said Thursday it applauded the release. But this leniency by Vietnam's one-party government contrasts sharply with its recent crackdowns on dissent. 35 activists have been jailed since early January, including 22 who received sentences Monday, ranging from 10 years to life. Rights activists say crackdowns have intensified in recent months. Phil Robertson, Deputy Asia Director at Human Rights Watch, said releasing Ding just before Tet, Vietnam's Lunar New Year holiday, is no excuse for jailing political dissidents on specious charges.
The important thing to remember also is that these people are being put away for things that shouldn't be considered crimes in the first place.
In other news, Vietnam last week deported Nguyen Quoc Quan, an American pro-democracy activist who was arrested at Ho Chi Minh City's airport last April. Quan is a leading member of Viet Thanh, a nonviolent pro-democracy group that Hanoi labels a terrorist organization. Mike Ives, FSRN, Hanoi.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doreen Marina in Los Angeles. President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, John Brennan, faced a Senate committee today with much of the focus on Brennan's role in the controversial drone killing program. In his opening statement, Brennan was repeatedly interrupted by protesters. One woman held a sign that read, "Brennan equals drone killing." Committee Chair Senator Dianne Feinstein cleared the room and refused to let Code Pink associates re-enter.
And I'm very pleased to be joined today by my wife, Kathy, and my brother, Tom.
I speak for the mothers.
All right. We will stop again.
In Yemen, all right. Pakistan, Somalia, and who else?
Please remove
the
that
CIA
woman.
The CIA and the Obama administration refuse to even tell Congress.
Brennan withdrew his bid to become CIA chief in 2008 after rising criticism about his role in the Bush administration's torture and extraordinary rendition program. According to a report last month from Reuters, Brennan had detailed contemporaneous knowledge of the CIA's use of so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding. For more, we're joined by Pardis Kabriai, senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much.
In the past 4 years, Brennan has served as Deputy National Security Advisor for Homeland Security and Counterterrorism under President Obama. What has been his role in shaping the U.S. policy on drone strikes and targeted killings?
Well, I think generally he's been one of the most vocal and strongest advocates and proponents of the targeted killing program. Literally, he's been one of the people, or if not the person, who's been side by side with President Obama making decisions about who they will kill next on the government's kill lists. It's an unprecedented program. The practice of killing outside of war zones in the way that the administration has described is clearly unlawful, and it's just incredibly dangerous in terms of the precedent this is setting for the international community, and John Brennan has had a central role.
You mentioned as part of that process this secret kill list that John Brennan is part of, along consulting with other officials, including President Obama. The New York Times reported on some of that process. What is known about who's on the list, how it's done, how it's created, and how those decisions are made?
So what we know, and really what we know is almost entirely from the work of journalists and advocates on the ground trying to get information, is that these killings happen in at least two ways. One is that a group of officials get together weekly, as the New York Times article described, in what they call Terror Tuesdays, and discuss lists of names and look at information the administration has on behalf of those people and make decisions about whether those people should be added to kill lists that are maintained by the CIA and by the covert Joint Special Operations Command of the U.S. military. So there are two primary groups involved in carrying out these killings. The other way that it happens actually accounts for the majority of killings, though, and those killings are what the administration calls signature strikes. And those happen after drones hovering above a group of people determine that those people are engaged in behavior that appears suspicious. And after, you know, determining on the basis of those patterns of behavior and criteria that are unknown to us, you know, they fire missiles and people are killed in that way as well. And actually that second way, the signature strikes way, despite that it's gotten less attention than the kill lists, actually account for the majority of the thousands of killings that have happened so far. They account for the majority of killings in Pakistan and most of what's happening in Yemen right now. So that practice needs attention, at least equal attention, as much attention as the kill list has gotten.
Well, John Brennan has argued that drone strikes are a necessary tool in anti-terrorism and that the process follows the rules of law. This is Brennan speaking in April 2012.
We are not a court. We're not trying to determine guilt or innocence and then carry out a strike in retaliation. What we're trying to do is prevent the loss of lives through terrorist attacks. So it's not as though we're, you know, sort of judge and jury on, again, their involvement in past activities.
Pardis Kabriai with the Center for Constitutional Rights, your response to that argument?
Well, it doesn't measure up to the information we have. So, for example, the memo, the white paper that was leaked earlier this week describing the government's rationale or the Department of Justice's rationale for the killing of U.S. citizens who it believes to be, you know, senior leaders of terrorist groups, they make clear in that memo that the use of lethal force is permissible in their view. In the face of an imminent threat, but the way they define imminence is to say that there's no clear evidence of an immediate attack necessary. So that statement alone, I mean, it's sort of they redefine or completely gut the meaning of imminence. And under the law, under constitutional law and under international law, the use of lethal force is clearly prohibited outside of war zones unless you have charged and tried someone or you're using lethal force in the face of an imminent threat. And imminence under the law means imminence. It's a plain term with ordinary meaning. And the way that the administration has redefined it and gutted it is just completely a violation of the law.
Pardis Kabriai, senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, joined us to speak about John Brennan's nomination to head the CIA. He faced a Senate confirmation hearing today. Pardis Kabriai, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Since the suicide last month of open internet activist Aaron Swartz, many of his friends and colleagues are calling for changes to the federal law under which he was charged, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Some of them gathered this week in Washington, D.C. for a memorial service, including Dan Goodwin, Swartz's co-worker at the organization ThoughtWorks. He said the harsh sentences from the decades-old law don't appropriately distinguish between people who take intellectual property for their own gain and those like Swartz who download content to share with the public.
Because so many years in prison can be threatened, it makes it extremely difficult for somebody to take a principled stand and say, no, that's not what the law says, that's not what the law means, that's not what the law should say, and stand up for it. Instead, they are pressured to make a plea and take some lesser punishment, and the entire injustice of the law isn't put to a test.
Several Democrats and Republicans from the House and Senate were also at the memorial. There, FSRN's Alice Olstein spoke to California Democrat Zoe Lofgren, who recently wrote a bill she named Aaron's Law. In the spirit of open access that Swartz championed, she shared a draft of the bill and asked for feedback on Reddit, the website he helped found.
The intent of the bill is to prevent the kind of abusive prosecution that Aaron faced for from happening to anyone else, both because it's wrong and also as a tribute to him.
And how would it do that?
By changing the elements of the overbroad law so that you couldn't charge. I mean, he engaged in an act of civil disobedience. When you engage in an act of civil disobedience, there'll be a consequence of some sort, but not 13 felonies and 35 years in federal prison. So the idea is to bring the statute under control.
And is this something that was on your radar before this tragedy, or did this sort of elevate it?
This definitely elevated it. Honestly, I didn't know really about the situation. It was only after he died that I realized what had happened. Now I'm hearing from other people around the country that similar things are happening to them. So this is not an isolated instance.
So you think that this has really put this on the radar of a lot of members of Congress?
Well, I hope so. There were a number of members here today, and senators as well. Senator Wyden's already indicated that he'll carry the bill on the Senate side, and I'm hopeful that we'll get a broad coalition. It's honestly, to have a number of members of Congress at a service such as this is not that usual. So it's really a tribute to all the things that Aaron did as a advocate for free speech and as a scientist and as a prodigy.
Are you also working on the other things that he worked on, the fights to keep the internet from censorship and
yes.
Corporate control?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things, and obviously Aaron's law isn't all of them, but I am working on a revision of copyright law that I know he would agree with. I wasn't a personal friend of his. I don't want to hold out that I was. I did meet him during the SOPA fight, and he played a very important role in fighting SOPA. You know, we have some other provisions on overbroad enforcement of copyright law, a bill in particular that has to do with academic papers that are very important, and I think there's ways to do that with the bill, and I'm also thinking there may be a way to do it with competition. So I'm also thinking how to approach it from the Science Committee I serve on, not just the Judiciary Committee.
That was California Democrat Zoe Lofgren speaking to FSRN's Alice Olstein. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden plans to introduce a version of Aaron's law in the Senate. Speaking at the memorial service, he promised to continue Aaron's march for freedom and a more just world.
When Aaron hacked, a poorly written criminal law called him a dangerous criminal. Common sense and conscience knows better. And we are going to change this unjust law because of Aaron and because of his family. This unjust law will not stand.
You're listening to FSRN. Stay with us. The Federal Court of Appeals heard arguments this week about the constitutionality of the National Defense Authorization Act. Lawyers for plaintiffs in the case Hedges v. Obama argued against the U.S. government defense of a section of the 2012 NDAA that critics say would allow the indefinite military detention without charges of U.S. citizens. FSRN's Linda Perry Barr reports.
We argued the case challenging the NDAA in the Court of Appeals.
Attorney Bruce Offron addressing the media and supporters after a federal appeals court hearing in downtown Manhattan. The case is Hedges versus Obama and was brought by Pulitzer-winning journalist Christopher Hedges in early 2012 in response to Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which states the military may detain without trial anyone belonging to Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces engaged in hostilities against the U.S., and any person who has directly supported such hostility in aid of enemy forces. Activists and journalists suing the government say this wording is vague, that the statute can be applied to citizens supporting causes and journalists reporting stories, and that military and civil society are separate and should be kept separate as dictated by the Constitution. Offron says if this power is upheld and used, it means Americans can be subjected to military imprisonment if the government deems they go too far in supporting an unpopular cause tied to the Middle East or terrorists. Hedges and his co-plaintiffs claim the code violates the First and Fifth Amendments. Again, Attorney Offron.
If someone raises money for Guantanamo inmates and sends that money to their lawyers to support their defenses, that could be substantial support of Al-Qaeda. If someone hosts a webcast and figures from terrorist groups or Al-Qaeda are invited, is that substantial support? This broad statute endangers basic speech.
Journalist and plaintiff Chris Hedges says the erosion of civil liberties has been worse under the Obama administration than it was under the Bush administration.
The use of the Espionage Act to shut down all whistleblowers, any narrative that challenged the official government narrative, the FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring, and eavesdropping of tens of millions of American citizens, and we know that our personal information is being stored in supercomputers in Utah, and now the National Defense Authorization Act, Section 1021, overturning 200 years of domestic law to allow the military onto our streets, to seize American citizens, strip them of due process, put them in military facilities, including our offshore penal colonies, and hold them indefinitely.
In federal district court in September, U.S. Judge Kathleen Forrest blocked the indefinite detention powers of the NDAA for American citizens after finding it unconstitutional. She issued an injunction staying enforcement, but that was overturned by the Court of Appeals. Now the appeal of Judge Forrest's original ruling is awaiting the decision of the panel of judges who heard the case this week. Daniel Ellsberg attended the hearing and was very pleased that Judge Forrest suggests the National Defense Authorization Act is an attempt to radically expand detention authority. Ellsberg says senators who are arguing for the indefinite detention of American citizens without charges are enemies of the Constitution.
And I'm afraid that is true of the president at this point in going along with this, having encouraged it earlier. And if every senator who votes for that, and let me remind you, every one of them as a civilian took the same oath that Bradley Manning took and that I took as a Marine. And that is not to obey the regulations of the Commander-in-Chief. It is solely to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
The panel of three judges will review the arguments and issue a ruling, but gave no indication when a decision would be released. Linda Perry Barr, FSRN.
Nagaland is home to one of India's oldest ethnic conflicts. Naga separatists in the country's northeast have been fighting for independence since 1947. The conflict has caused continued economic, social, and political instability in the region. Many civilians avoid public dialogue, but now the internet and social media are giving young Nagas a platform to discuss and debate politics openly. With assembly elections scheduled later this month, the online community is raising some key issues. FSRN's Gayatri Parameswaran and Felix Gayetka report from Nagaland.
Nagaland, a state with a population of about 2 million, is currently administered by India. 65 years ago, the Naga National Council, today known as the Federal Government of Nagaland, began a movement for self-determination. Luvitsu, who goes by one name, is the speaker of FGN.
Even before India became a nation, Nagas, fearing that our leaders went even up to Delhi to meet Mahatma Gandhi, that and told them that you should not be confused. Nagas are separate and Nagas will remain separate. Will not join you. When that was told to Mahatma Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi said, we have every right to be independent.
After that meeting, the Naga National Council declared an independent Nagaland in 1947. The Naga National Council claims to have conducted a plebiscite in 1951, but the Indian government rejected its claims. A deadlock continued and India deployed its army in Nagaland. In 1956, the Naga National Council's armed wing began fighting the Indian army.
We are still living in fear of Indian army's notorious activities. We cannot move freely and we cannot speak our rights, because whenever we speak our rights, we'll get beaten.
Over the years, rebel groups have taken up arms to fight for independence. Between 2004 and 2007, over 300 people died in armed conflict in Nagaland, according to an advocacy group called Geneva Declaration. But many in Nagaland have distanced themselves from the struggle, and some young people express disillusionment with the independent fighters. Robert Solo is a church youth leader.
People have been silenced for so many years, but now everywhere the need is very much felt now to speak the truth and then to go for what is right. And then, and also people are fed up of violence, and then everywhere there is a big question on the leadership. We don't trust our leaders anymore.
The silence that has long prevailed is now being replaced by an active online discussion. Various groups on Facebook, such as the Naga Blog, Naga Spear, She Naga, and Nagaland Times, are providing a platform like never before for the youth to raise their voices and engage with each other. Peter Rutsa is an administrator at the Naga Blog or TNB group on Facebook.
Here on the internet, we can have a discussion on any topic by sitting in our living rooms, in our kitchen. So it's accessible to lots of people, ordinary people, who cannot afford to come to Kohima or Dimapur to write an article that they want to share with the general population. And the nice thing about it is, about not just the TNB but Facebook, is lots of people can log in from their mobiles, cheap mobiles.
The growth in online engagement is happening as Nagaland gears up for assembly elections. Many political entities, including the federal government of Nagaland, have opposed the polls. Luvitsu says the election will only bring another puppet government in place.
We are going to tell our people not to pay much attention to the forced and bogus sham election, because Indian election is not ours. We have nothing to do with the Indian elections.
The elections have also led to a heated discussion on Facebook. Robert Solo started a new online campaign called the Clean Election. The campaign also involves offline activity. Solo and other members have been meeting party leaders and urging them to regulate their election spending.
Now, you see, in these 2 years, the central government has sanctioned 5,600 crores. To Nagaland state for development, but nothing has happened. Now we desire for the things to happen here. That is one of the reasons why we have been approaching most of the candidates.
On the Naga blog, there's a poll running. Who do you think will win the 2013 elections? Comments on the poll reflect the lack of trust the Nagas have in the system. One person wrote, "The voters are unfortunate because they are left with no choice but to choose between the two evils." Voting will take place on February 23rd. With Felix Gatekar, this is Gayatri Parameshwaran, Nagaland FSRN.
And that's the program for today. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.